Welcome to the Big Book Study from Over Ears Anonymous, the LAOA birthday. Welcome. This is the Big Book Study. I always feel like this is like a plane, and if you need to know where you're going, this is a Big Book Study. We're not going to somewhere else. We're going to the Big Book Study. My name is Roxanne Whitney. I've been an Overeaters Anonymous since February 14th, 1986, and I'm also an Alcoholics Anonymous. That's a separate issue. And my OA birthday dates from February 14th, 1987. So I've been in OA for a while. This is the fifth Big Book Study that I've done, but I also do four-step workshops, so I do that. And Linda Brown is going to introduce herself too, but I just wanted to say that I'm grateful that you're here. It's always exciting to do service at this level, but it's also really exciting when people attend. Because the attending part is super cool for us. I'm glad to see that there are people here who are interested in the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'm hoping a lot of you have a Big Book, and if you don't, it's not going to be that exciting, but you'll still have a good time. So let's see. I think that I covered that. The bathrooms are out the door and to the left and right?
Mm-hmm. Left and then immediately right.
Okay. I think we'll just, Linda is going to introduce herself, and then we'll just start. Halfway through this session, the session goes from 10:30 to 12:15, so about halfway through, we're going to offer the Ask It basket, so if you have any questions, you can write them down on the post-it notes that are in there. So let's see. Maybe somebody, can you be in charge of your section of the basket, and can you be in charge of your section? That would be great. And we'll stop the meeting today at noon and ask and answer any questions in the Ask It basket. I'm grateful you're here. Thank you. Take it, Linda.
My name's Linda Brown. I'm a compulsive overeater. And there's post-it notes up here. If you do have your book and you want to make notes, you can help yourself to the post-it notes. And I, like Roxanne, am extremely honored, and I consider it a privilege to be able to share my recovery and participate in your recovery. And I love the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. It's it has saved my life. I, too, am a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I love Overeaters Anonymous. I didn't know that I was a compulsive overeater until I found out I was an alcoholic. So it was really, it's been an eye-opening experience, and I've found a place where I fit and where I belong, and where we can talk about, you know, eating too many Smarties, and it's okay. So if you got the survey, I just want everybody to remember, if you got the survey, you'll find Big Book Workshop. It's the sixth one down, and the five is all the way to the right. So if you can remember that,
yeah,
maybe we'll get invited back if you remember that.
Yeah.
Thanks for having us.
And again, I think I forgot to say this. I'm Roxanne Whitney. I'm a compulsive overeater. Did I say that?
Hi, Roxanne.
Okay. I know I said a bunch of other stuff. Anyway, so here's the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. I have the big book because I have macular degeneration, so I'm not as good a reader as Linda is, and you'll always be relieved when she reads because you'll think, oh, thank God. But I try hard, and, you know, you have to give me extra points for disability. So this is the large print version, large print. And I know that they offer this book for sale somewhere here and at the birthday party. So if you're, I know, somewhere. So what we are going to do is take you through the first pages up to page 80-something, 70-something. We have it totally planned. I don't want you to think this is random. We have this totally planned. We've done this before. 76. So basically, here's the deal. The Big Book is organized in a way that is kind of magical. It has the problem section, it has the solution section, it has the plan of action section. Okay? And so we're going to start with the preface. The very, very first part is the preface. Well, the first part is the table of contents. And the table of contents tells you, we're going to cover this later because it'll make more sense later. But basically, we're going to start at the preface of the first page, which is in Roman numerals X1. So it looks like this. Okay, so here is the still. We've got the table of contents and then just the actual first page with any writing on it. We're going to start there. And it's talking about, so this is the first preface written. It's talking about the different editions of the Big Book and when they were written and why they were written and why it's important. So, you ready?
Ready.
Go.
So the second paragraph, because this book has become the basic text, which lets us know that we're supposed to study this. A textbook is something that you study. It's something that you review time and time again to learn the material. It's not a novel. You read it, you cry, you put it down. We study this book. So because this book has become our basic text and for our society and has helped such large number of compulsive overeating men and women into recovery, there exists strong sentiment against any radical changes being made in it. So
as a result of that, there's some stuff in the Big Book that is politically like there's a story that used to be in the first edition was called Join the Tribe, and it was by an American Indian, and they kind of moved that. So and then there's a like. You know, it was written in 1938. What can I say? There's some things changed. The second, turn the page, and at the very bottom of the page, we're still on the preface. If you have a drinking problem, see food problem. We hope that you may pause in reading one of the 42 personal stories and think, yes, that has happened to me, or more important, yes, I feel like that, or most important, yes, I believe this program can work for me too. And when I came into Overeaters Anonymous in 1986, we didn't have literature like we have today. We had we used the Big Book as a plan of action. We didn't have the OA 12 and 12, and we didn't have we didn't have any other OA books other than the Lifetime Sampler and the book called Overeaters Anonymous, which we used to call the Chocolate Book. And we used to say, my first sponsor said, you take the first 164 pages of the Big Book and you put the Chocolate Book behind for the stories, and that's the program of recovery. Okay, so that's how I learned. And then the next thing that we're going to do is the forward to the first edition.
And that's on page XIII. We of Alcoholics Anonymous, Overeaters Anonymous, are more than 100 men and women who have recovered from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. To show other compulsive overeaters precisely how we have recovered is the main purpose of this book. For them, we hope these pages will prove so convincing that no further authentication will be necessary. We think this account of our experiences will help everyone to better understand the compulsive overeater. Many do not comprehend that the compulsive overeater is a very sick person, and besides, we are sure that our way of living has its advantages for all.
And then at the bottom of the page, the last sentence, we are not an organization in the conventional sense of the word. There are no fees, no dues, whatever. The only requirement for membership is an honest desire to stop compulsively eating. We are not allied with any particular faith, sect, or denomination, nor do we oppose anyone. We simply wish to be helpful to those who are afflicted. So that's the end of the forward to the first edition.
And that particular paragraph is the first time, and this forward was written in 1939, since it's the first forward. That's the first time that the traditions, which we share in common with Alcoholics Anonymous, was ever placed into some type of written form. So that's the first place that the traditions ever appear, and they don't actually get written and approved by Alcoholics Anonymous for several years later in 1955.
Okay, so the forward to the second edition at the bottom of the page, page XV. This is the beginning of kind of the history of Alcoholics Anonymous, which is our history. The spark that was to flare into the first AA group was struck in Akron, Ohio in June of 1935 during a talk between a New York stockbroker and an Akron physician. 6 months earlier, the broker had been relieved of his obsession by a sudden spiritual experience following a meeting with an alcoholic friend who had been in contact with the Oxford groups of the day. He had also been greatly helped by the late Dr. William D. Selkworth, a New York specialist in alcoholism, who is encountered no less than a medical saint by AA members, and whose story of the early days of the society appears in the next pages. Basically, there's a ton of history that's really important for us to understand that this was this program, Alcoholics Anonymous, was really put together by God, because it was so unlikely that Bill and Dr. Bob would meet. But basically, the guy who wrote the big book, his name is Bill Wilson. He was a horrible drunk. He was also a stock speculator. He wasn't a stockbroker. He was a guy who got lucky before the Depression and then got really unlucky. And the fact that they were both, one of the weird coincidences is that both Dr. Bob, the Akron physician, and Bill Wilson were involved in the Oxford Groups, which doesn't exist today. The Oxford Group was a first century Christian organization. They had six steps that Bill Wilson expanded to be 12 steps. The six steps were crazy hard to adhere to. More history is going to be revealed when we go through the book, but the six steps of the Oxford Group were this. One, admission of personal defeat. You've been defeated by sin. That was their deal. Two, taking a personal inventory. List your sins. Three, confession of one sin to another person. Four, making restitution to those one has harmed. Five, helping others selflessly. Six, praying to God for guidance and the power to put these precepts into action. And this, there's just the idea of that makes me want to go and eat some. So, like, I just think, what? I wouldn't even know where to begin. So basically, and I think Bill Wilson thought the same thing. He knew that we would not be able to do that. He knew that we needed a little more help, and that's how we came up with the expanded version of the 12 tradition of the 12 steps. Okay, so we're just going to keep going. Bottom of the page, you go.
The last paragraph. The physician, so this is Dr. Bob, had repeatedly tried spiritual means to resolve his alcoholic dilemma, but had failed. But when the broker gave him Dr. Silkworth's description of alcoholism and its hopelessness, the physician began to pursue the spiritual remedy for his malady with a willingness he had never before been able to muster. He sobered, never to drink again, up to the moment of his death in 1950. This seemed to prove that one alcoholic could affect another as no non-alcoholic could. It also indicated that strenuous work, one alcoholic working with another, was vital to permanent recovery.
Okay, so we're going to skip, skip, skip. This is really important history, but we're going to skip it because we want to get in as much as possible. So we end up on page XX121 in Roman numerals, the bottom of the paragraph. Upon therapy for compulsive overeaters himself, we surely have no monopoly. There used to be a lot of ways you could get abstinent in outside of Overeaters Anonymous. For a long time, there was like a medical facility in Torrance called the Rader Institute. I don't even know if that's still there, but people, when I came into program, the Rader Institute was all that. People would go there all the time. And there's lots of other ways that people can stop eating compulsively. Yet, it is our great hope that all those who have as yet found no answer may begin to find one in these pages of the book and will presently join us on the high road to a new freedom.
On the bottom of the foreword to the third edition, the very last paragraph, in spite of the great increase in size and the span of this fellowship, at its core remains simple and personal. Each day, somewhere in the world, recovery begins when one compulsive overeater talks with another, a compulsive overeater, sharing experience, strength, and hope.
And then the forward to the fourth edition. We are people who normally would not mix. That is so an understatement. We would normally not
mix. We need pictures. This is like where you need pictures.
Yeah,
in the
we would not mix. In a good way. And then the next, at the bottom of the page, just a little bit above the bottom of the page, like so much of OA's basic text, of OAA's basic text, these words have proved to be far more visionary than the founding members could have ever imagined. In other words, we, like, grab each other because we found a common solution. And the common solution is a bond. It's like epoxy. And it makes it so we may not agree on religion, politics, everything, but we agree on the fact that this program works and that there is a solution. And at the bottom of page XX1V24.
Now, I like this line, and Roxanne doesn't believe when I tell her that this goes on in OA, but it says here, and by the way, so this fourth, forward to the fourth edition, I think that was written in 2001. So modem to modem, so or Wi-Fi to Wi-Fi, or face-to-face, AAs and OAs, speak the language of the heart in all its power and simplicity. And I think that, like no other 12-step organization, online meetings are such a huge tool and practice in Overeaters Anonymous. And, I mean, I know we talk about it a lot at Orange County Intergroup. And we, you know, I just think that it's so visionary what we're doing, and it's just so fast forward. And it's going to be, I mean, I've attended online meetings for Alcoholics Anonymous, and you're just like, you know, I don't get it, but it's not for me. But when OAs get together and they're online and you're talking about what's going on because you can't get to a meeting, you know, because they aren't as readily available, maybe it's just an amazing experience.
So,
okay, you believe me now?
I'm a believer now.
I'm done.
That was
My
very effective.
Done.
So, okay, so the next chapter is the doctor's opinion. The doctor's opinion is, Dr. Silkworth basically treated Bill. When we get to Bill's story, it'll talk about it. Dr. Silkworth worked in a hospital called the Towns Hospital. It was on Riverside Drive. And the cost to be in this hospital in 1933, I have this written down somewhere, and I don't know where it is.
It's 33 to 38.
Yeah. Was expensive. Like $600 a week?
$350 for 5 days.
That's right.
I wrote
it down. $350 for 5 days in 1928 money. I mean, 1933 money. So, like, really expensive.
Bill didn't have that kind of money, though.
No, but his father-in-law did. So, he borrowed money. So, basically, we're going to start on Dr. Silkworth, on the doctor's opinion. And Dr. Silkworth was a doctor who got his medical degree right before the Depression, so he didn't have a job. So he took the first job that he could, which was for Mr. Towns, who owned this hospital, and he said, "You'll be practicing alcoholism doctoring." And he didn't know anything about it, but he learned a lot about it really fast. So he's considered, I mean, he's an authority. In the years that he started to work, he became an authority on alcoholism. Okay.
So on page XXVI, probably about the second sentence down, in the regular print, you can tell that the doctor's opinion, what the doctor writes, is in a much smaller font, in a smaller print in the book. But we're going to read what the alcoholics wrote in this book here. And it says, in this statement, he confirms what we who have suffered from compulsive overeating or alcoholic torture must believe, that the body of the compulsive overeater is quite as abnormal as his mind. And then just a few more lines down. These things were true to some extent, in fact, to a considerable extent with some of us. We had to, one more line down, in our belief, any picture of the compulsive overeater which leaves out this physical allergy factor is incomplete. So we have a physical allergy. I think if you can find yourself in the doctor's opinion, you've done a lot of work. I think you've done a lot of work if you can find yourself there.
Also, just keep in mind that what we're looking for is, Linda and I have talked about this before, but we have little post-it notes all over our book, and one of the reasons why is in order to find ourselves in the big book, we have to kind of adjust some words, and there's some sentences that we just completely ignore, but because they just don't make sense. But it's really easy for me to say, look, I'm powerless over glazed donuts. I haven't had a glazed donut since 1986. And so for me, if I have trouble finding myself in the doctor's opinion, it's because I'm not trying. All I have to do is, just for me, is to say glazed donuts. I just can't stop at one, and 100 isn't enough. 12 isn't enough. Okay, so that's what I do. I have, find out whatever your post-it note is. My post-it note is glazed donuts, although there are plenty of other things that I can add to that list, but Oreos. But so find something that fits with. I mean, we're not here because we had a walk in the park with food. So okay.
There's a line here that says, but as ex-problem eaters, we can say that his explanation makes good sense. It explains many things for which we cannot otherwise account. And so maybe Roxanne can't tell you why she can't stop eating glazed donuts once she starts. I can tell you that because I believe I have an allergy to Smarties, specifically Smarties. If I eat one Smartie, I'm going to eat the whole bag of Smarties. That's just how it goes for me. I can't do it.
Can you confirm what page you're on?
Right. We are on XXVI, we're at the very bottom of the page where it says, his explanation makes good sense. It explains many things for which we can otherwise not account. So, and here was one of the other things that I learned early on. I don't have to know why. Sometimes I don't have to know why. I just have to know that I don't have to look for the differences, but I have to find myself. I have to find myself here so that I can stay here with you, and I like you, so I want to stay. So I make an effort to find myself.
Yeah, that's a really good point. So find out whatever your post-it note is. It doesn't have to be glazed donuts. It can be apples. God bless you. Awesome. So, okay, so we're going to be, now we're switching to the next page, which is?
XXBII.
Okay, and in the middle of, so he's talking about just basically, the deal that Dr. Silkworth has is he presents the issue of physical allergy and mental obsession. The physical allergy, the way it works in AA is, I got a drink, and once you start drinking, you can't stop, okay? The way it works for me in OA is I think it's time to eat, I'm going to be eating now, and I can't, and once I'm there, I can't make a decision about wise choices, okay? So the whole of the doctor's opinion is about the physical allergy and the mental obsession. So he's just going to line it up for us, and also the only cure for this. The only cure for this disease, the physical allergy, mental obsession, is what he calls moral psychology, which is like, what? Moral psychology is basically what he's saying is you got to find a higher power. You have to find a God. That's pretty much his, but we'll read it anyway.
Okay, so it's the fourth paragraph down. And it starts with we doctors. We doctors have realized for a long time that some form of moral psychology was of urgent importance to compulsive overeaters, but its application presented difficulties beyond our conception. What with our ultra-modern standards, our scientific approach to everything, we were perhaps not well equipped to apply the powers of good, and I like to say the powers of God, that lie outside our synthetic knowledge.
And then down at the bottom of the page, they believe in themselves. He's talking about the people who wrote the book. They believe in themselves and still more in the power which pulls a chronic compulsive overeater, alcoholic, back from the gates of death. And the question is, do I believe? So I'm reading this chapter for the first time. I've never seen this chapter in my life. And I come into Overeaters Anonymous and I read this and I think, do I believe that this program, that God will pull me back from the gates of death? Well, maybe not at this point, but by the time I finish the book, I'm totally there.
Right. Do you believe in OA? Do you believe in abstinence? Do you believe in God? If you can get those, if you can get there, you're lucky.
So the next page, XXV111, right?
Right. The next page.
The second paragraph, he's talking about, we believe in, and so suggested a few years ago, that the action of alcohol/food on these chronic compulsive overeaters is a manifestation of an allergy. The phenomenon of craving is limited to this class and never occurs in the average temperate eater. And then the next sentence, and once having formed the habit and found that they cannot break it, once having lost their self-confidence and their reliance upon things human, their problems pile up on them and become astonishingly difficult to solve. And Linda has awesome problems.
I do. I have great problems. Well, I like circled the word pile, and then I have a nice shiny arrow that points to my highest weight. That's a problem. And for me, you know, I can't, when I'm at that weight, I can't move around. So, if you know, I recognize that as a problem. But I also, once I started applying the 12 steps and working the 12 steps when it came to my compulsive overeating, I started looking at my problems, and I realized the higher my weight, the bigger my problems. The lower my weight, the lower my problems. And like I can tell you, at my highest weight, I was $50,000 in debt to the IRS, and I had been my taxes were piling up, because he says, you know, our problems pile up. So I go, oh, okay, so my taxes were piling up, my divorces were piling up, I was racking those suckers up, and the violence in my life was piling up. Like, you know, the higher my weight, the more violent the fights were with my ex-husbands. And I could recognize that, you know, being blocked off from the sunlight of the spirit, once I started doing the work that it takes that we're going to talk about today, I could see that those problems piled up. So that's what I wanted to say.
Yeah, and about. Also, my problems are not like Linda's problems. My problems piled up whatever weight I was. When I weighed 130, I had a pile of problems. And one of the problems was I used to put my daughter in the car and drive for 15 minutes so I could go to a special bakery and buy two muffins, throw the bottoms away because I only ate muffin tops. And I keep her in the car, and because there is a law against letting your kids stay in the car while you go shopping. But I kept her in the car because I just kept the car running, and so I felt like that was acceptable. And I went and got my muffin tops.
I am shocked that they gasp at the fact that you left your kid in the car, but not that you threw the bottoms of the car.
Shocking. I know, thank you.
I don't know who I would.
I heard you gasp.
I'm going to rip the top off and eat that because that's the best part. But I'm going to save the bottom.
Throw it away right
now.
Like, when
I can't get in the car and go get the muffin.
Yeah.
Like, I didn't get that. But I like that you guys are super compassionate over the kid.
Yeah, I do like that.
Compassionate over the muffin.
Right.
So
yeah,
bad.
Really.
Also, and that lets me qualify.
Yeah.
Like, that lets
just
me
the
qualify.
Laughter. The laughter. And then the
qualify.
Other two ways that I qualify, because it's important that Linda and I qualify as compulsive overeaters, just so you don't think we're trying to kid you. I was in a really nice restaurant with my husband, and his company owned the...
Do you want to take your mic off?
His company owned... his company owned the restaurant that... The company he worked at with, actually, the company where Linda works, owned the restaurant, and so we were surrounded by people who he worked with, and he wanted some of my dessert, and I stabbed him with a fork, and I had to leave. I had to leave. We had to leave the restaurant before I got what I wanted, before I got my apple tart, and so my problems were piling up because all of a sudden my husband knew something wrong was with me. Something is wrong with me. His wife just stabbed him. Okay?
But he never, ever reached across the table again. I will tell you that.
I like that idea, but I think he has. But anyway. Okay, so the next paragraph. Now we've qualified. The next paragraph is...
Starts with the word frothy. Again,
frothy.
We're still on page 28 in Roman numerals.
Right. Frothy emotional appeal seldom suffices. The message which can interest and hold compulsive overeater people must have depth and weight. In nearly all cases, these ideals must be grounded in a power greater than themselves if they are to recreate their lives. So basically, he's starting to form the instruction to us, and it's basically nothing's going to work unless you get a relationship with God.
Get a God.
Mm-hmm.
That's what he's telling you. He's telling you get a God. And I always like the word weight in there. I like the word.
Yeah, I do too.
It just makes me feel good.
Okay, the bottom of the third paragraph is, we found after many years of experience that we have found nothing which has contributed more to the rehabilitation of these men and women than the altruistic movement now growing up among them. He's talking about, so Dr. Silkworth is writing this about AA.
Right. No,
okay.
No profit motive, just wanting to do the right thing. That's
right.
What we're talking about when we talk about all. So at the very bottom of the last paragraph, to them, their only compulsive overeating life seems the only normal one. They are restless, irritable, and discontented unless they can again experience the ease and comfort which comes at once by taking. And so here's what we want you to do. If you have a sticky note, because the book says by taking a few drinks. And so what I've done is I put a sticky note, like Roxanne's sticky note might be the glazed donut, but and it, you know what, you can have more than one sticky note, but just for me, when I think about this, like, okay, so my Smarties story is that, like, three times a week I would leave my office and drive to Big Lots that was maybe 2 miles away because they sold, like, these huge bags of Smarties. And all I could, like, when I was out, it was bad. I was like, oh, my God, I'm out of Smarties. And so I'd have to get in the car on my lunch hour and race over there. And, like, just getting in the car, knowing, like, watching the clock, waiting for an acceptable hour to leave the office for lunch, like, there's all this anxiety, and I'm, like, going, I got to get my Smartie fixed, and I'm like a junkie or something. And I'm driving over there. Like, the minute I hit, like, Moulton, I'm like, yeah, I'm a block away. Like, I felt that ease and comfort before the Smartie even hit my lips, man. I felt it. I knew what was going to happen. I knew what was going to go down. I was going to unwrap those suckers, make piles and piles and piles of Smartie, and just eat them like there was no tomorrow. So I like to talk about my Smarties. But make a sticky note.
Get a sticky note.
Get something that you know just the thought takes you to that.
Yeah.
Oh, you guys don't know what Smarties are? Okay, so Smarties are these little...
They're called Sweet Tarts.
Sweet Tarts. Well, they're not Sweet Tarts, though, but they're not... No, wait, don't insult the Smarties.
Okay.
Right, they're not like M&M's. They are like little sugar pills. They are sugar pills. They're
colored.
Colored sugar pills. Pastel colored. Yes, sir.
Okay.
No. My dad was a teacher. Maybe that's what it was. I can blame him. There's the cause and condition.
Yeah,
my
really.
Dad was a teacher. So, no. I mean, it's just, yeah, I love Smarties. If I, you know, trick-or-treating, I wouldn't steal the Twix from my kid. I'd go, oh, here, you don't want those. And I'd take all the Smarties. And she'd be like, I like the Smarties. You don't like those. They're garbage. That's
yeah.
Cheap candy. You don't need it. So get a sticky note.
And
put it over what the big book says. A few drinks and make that, you know, and it can, I mean, I can also, yes, in the back?
Sounds like heroin.
Right, exactly. That's what I said. I was a junkie.
And then the other part of this last sentence that Linda read that starts with, they are restless, irritable, and discontented. If you're ever in a Big Book Jeopardy contest, this is where that section is in the book. It's a Jeopardy question. Because restless, irritable, and discontented really transfers between alcoholism and compulsive overeaters.
Right.
We know what that means. Okay.
We are on page 29, Roman numeral 29, XXIX.
Okay, at the top of the page, that's where it says, which comes at once by taking a few bites. Okay. And then the next, where we are?
After they have succumbed to the desire again, as so many do, the phenomenon of craving develops. They pass through well-known stages of a spree, emerging remorseful, with a firm resolution not to sticky note again. This is repeated over and over. And unless this person can experience an entire psychic change, there is little hope of his recovery.
Okay, and then the next paragraph. Once a psychic change has occurred, the very same person who seemed doomed, who had so many problems he despaired of ever solving them, suddenly finds himself easily able to control his desire for food. The only effort necessary being that required to follow a few simple rules, the steps.
I hated that word rules, but
when it's saying follow a few simple rules,
right.
What it's saying is, take the steps.
That's right.
That's right.
Get a psychic change
right.
to relieve me of the obsession
absolutely.
Or my binge items.
Yep.
Right.
Right?
Yeah, absolutely.
So if I take the steps, I will be relieved of the obsession.
Right.
Okay. And then down the next paragraph, one feels that something more than human power is needed to produce the essential psychic change. It's in the middle of the paragraph.
Get a God.
So that's basically... The doctor's opinion is all about getting a God that will produce the psychic change.
I have to say, too, let me interject. The doctor's opinion for me has also helped me to put that down. and beat myself up because I am a compulsive eater and I'm addicted to sugar flour in quantity. It has helped me to stop beating myself up because I know what's wrong now.
Yeah, the doctor's opinion is transformational. That's why we want to make sure that everybody reads that.
Okay.
And then the bottom of the last paragraph on that page, no?
I can
go to the next
right.
one.
So
no?
We can read that. Let's read, and actually it's this last sentence of the
yes.
second to the last paragraph. Many types do not respond to ordinary psychological approach. I do not hold with those who believe that compulsive overeating is entirely a problem of mental control. And if that was it, like I'm pretty sure that there are some extremely intelligent people in this room, and if it was a problem of mental control, I think we could collectively get it, right? I think we could figure it out here. But so when somebody goes, well, you just need some willpower. You just need to not eat the Smarties. I don't get that. I don't get it. And they don't get it, which is more important. So for me, and that you do, and that I have a fellowship that gets it, is so significant.
Okay, the next page.
Page 30, Roman numeral 30.
Right.
This entire page talks about the mental obsession, the compulsion, the spiritual malady, and the addiction, the physical addiction. And so we're not going to read the entire page, but in the second paragraph, the last line, they are over-remorseful and make many resolutions, but never a decision. And I can say that, you know, I have made a ton of resolutions, like New Year's resolutions especially, right? Like, oh, yeah, this is it. I'm going to start my diet January 1, right? So let's go down just a little bit more. There's a paragraph to the right, at the bottom center. It says, then there are the types that are entirely normal, and I like to write and cute, entirely
yes.
normal and cute, in every respect except with the effect that food has upon them, and they are often able, intelligent, friendly people. And so all of you here are in that group right
yep.
there. If you ask me, and if I get to be the boss of the world, you are all able, intelligent, cute, and friendly. And that's why you're in OA.
We're on page 30, but now we're moving to 31, the Roman numeral 31 at the very top of the page. What is the solution? Perhaps I can best answer this by relating one of my experiences. And basically, we're not going to read this whole thing, but he's talking about the concept of hope. Okay? We're going to pick up the story halfway down the paragraph. He accepted the plan outlined in the book. 1 year later, he called to see me, and I experienced a very strange sensation. He's talking about a guy who he met, and he shared his concept of the physical allergy, mental obsession, and the fact that he had to find a God. And he had a very strange sensation. I knew the man by name and partly recognized his features, but there all resemblance ended. From a trembling, despairing, nervous wreck, I had emerged a man brimming over with self-reliance and contentment. Like contentment, what a concept. And this man was transformed. And so Dr. Silkworth is telling us, look, here's the deal. It's one thing to tell you that well, here's the problem, here's the solution. But this guy was walking big book. He had worked the steps and he was transformed. He found a higher power. And so basically he's telling us what to do. The last page, the last paragraph of this doctor's opinion.
On the page 30, I have it underlined. It's one of the things on the second to the last paragraph, the only relief we have to get is entire abstinence.
Correct. Right. That's our only solution. That's it. That's your and if you don't like if you don't get a God and you don't want to get abstinent, yeah, you're screwed.
That would be like a drunk working the steps while they're drinking.
Right.
I can't work the steps if I'm in my binge item.
Right. So the last paragraph on page 32. I earnestly advise every alcoholic compulsive overeater to read this book all the way through. Don't skimp. And though perhaps he came to scoff, he may remain to pray. So, you know, we got to get a higher power. We got to figure out what that is for us, and that happens as most of you have taken the steps. We'll find that. But what he's saying here is, don't leave because we're going to talk about God.
Don't leave. Don't leave.
Okay, and so basically we go right into Bill's story. Bill's story begins on step one. Okay. On page one, sorry. And hold on, I'm just checking my little timer thing.
We have our Ask It basket. So if you guys, if you have any questions so that we can get through the material the way we've laid it out based on the time that we're given, if you could just put your questions in the basket, we're going to have the Ask It basket, period.
Yeah, so that would be great. So write down your questions, and that way we can address them at noon. So we're going to start with Bill's story. First of all, let me just say that Bill Wilson wrote this book. He wrote the first 176 pages up until Dr. Bob's Nightmare. He did it with the help of a lot of other people. However, he really pretty much wrote the book. He changed a couple words, and we'll kind of go over that, what he changed. But basically, if this was a program of attraction and all I did was read Bill's story, I wouldn't have an attraction. He's not my kind of guy. He's a smooth talker, high stepper, spends always flashing a wad of cash.
I'm hanging out with Bill.
I love Dr. Bob. I think Dr. Bob is awesome. But Bill was the kind of guy that I dated when I was drinking. Super flashy, full of himself, totally fancied himself, and he was a promoter, right? Now, Alcoholics Anonymous needed a promoter to get it organized and going, so I'm grateful for that. But his personality isn't endearing, and it doesn't soften my heart. However, he wrote the book and carried the message, so I'm good about that. We're going to go to page... What are we doing?
I'm going to go to page three.
Page three. Got it.
Page three, the second paragraph. So, again, Bill, being the promoter, he's gone to war, he's come back, he's into making his fortune, and he says, for the next few years, fortune threw money and applause my way. I had arrived. And then we skip a couple lines. Drink was taking an important and exhilarating part in my life. There was loud talk in the jazz places uptown. Everyone spent in thousands and chattered in millions. I made a host of fair-weathered friends. And for me, like, I can look at this, and I have to find myself. I've got to find myself here. Oh, I loved going out to eat, and I loved going out to eat at fancy restaurants where the portions were too small, so you had to order two. And who cared how much it cost? It was really, really good, so you just ordered two. So that's how I found myself when Bill's talking about, you know, I was spending in thousands and chattering in millions, and I didn't have any because I was ripping off the IRS.
My drinking assumed more serious proportions, continuing all day and almost every night. The remonstrances of my friends terminated in a row, and I became a lone wolf. There were many unhappy scenes in our sumptuous apartment. I think it's a riot that he says sumptuous apartment because he wants us to know how awesome he was. But that's okay, because I had sumptuous apartments, too. And when he says there had been real no infidelity, he was loyal to his wife, not so much. However, I am grateful for him. So I want to honor his memory and say, yeah, we love you. He's awesome. And there's two things that I wanted to say. One was when in 1929, when the stock market crashed, you used to be able to buy stock just with 10% down. So if a stock was sold for $100, all you needed was 10 bucks. And so that's why people jumped off the buildings, not because they lost money, but because they owed more money than they had, way more. So basically, he was a stock speculator. Okay, we're going to go to the next, page five.
Page five. Here, Bill's talking about alcohol. Liquor ceased to be a luxury. It became a necessity. And I can tell you my experience as a compulsive overeater, I didn't eat for nutrition. It was something, where for us, like, we eat because it's a necessity. It was not something that I could take it or leave it ever again. Like, food was right here. Food was right here. And everything else was below it. So that's my experience. And the very last sentence in that paragraph, nevertheless, I still fought, and again, because I am smart. Remember, they described us, we're intelligent
and cute.
Nevertheless, I still thought I could control the situation, and there were periods of abstinence which renewed my wife's hopes. And, yeah, there were, you know, like the first 2 weeks of drinking water and eating lemons, that, like, renewed my hope, because, like, I would lose 10 pounds. I'd be like, woohoo, I lost 10 pounds. And then I think, okay, I can do this. I don't have to ever pick up a bag of Smarties or a bag of Lay's potato chips ever again. I can live on water and lemons.
And the basic story, what's happening in the progress of the story that we're not reading is Bill's drinking a lot and he's lost all his money, and then he got another partner and he lost all his money again. And it just is, it's like a grim story. He just, things keep getting worse and worse for him. In the fourth paragraph, I woke up. This had to be stopped. I saw I could not so much as take one drink. And then the next paragraph, shortly afterwards, I came home drunk. So he got sober and then he got drunk again. And he had binged. There had been no fight. Where had been my high resolve? I simply didn't know. It hadn't even come to mind. Somebody pushed a drink his way. Somebody at Christmas time. Somebody shoves a plate of cookies at you, and I just go, oh yeah, we'll be eating those. Okay, and then the next page, page six, and the first paragraph on the next page.
The remorse, horror, and hopelessness of the next morning are unforgettable. The courage to do battle was not there. My brain raced uncontrollably, and there was a terrible sense of impending calamity.
And if what I have here is my example. I have a sticky note here that basically is my example. The remorse and terror and hopelessness of the next morning was unforgettable. My example was I used to have my suitcase packed by the front door, and that was an unwritten comment to my husband was, better be good because I'm leaving. Like, that was the kind of life I led. And I hated my husband. I hated my house. I hated my job. I couldn't work, and I hated my job. I was impatient and intolerant with my daughter. And all I could do, I used to have a walk-in pantry that had like 18 inches like of standing space. I used to walk in, close the pantry, and eat frozen chocolate chips. That was the best I could do. And so when I look at this, the remorse, horror, and I knew that was not a way to raise a child. I knew that. The horror and hopelessness of the next morning was unforgettable. And the next morning, when you weigh yourself 17 times, it was unforgettable. So Bill has written this, all these terrible things that are happening in the next paragraph, in the second sentence, it says, he was to do this for 2 more years. And like I had some years of doing that. Anyway, the next page is page number 7.
What do you have?
I have he goes to Towns Hospital for the first time.
Right. I was placed in a nationally known hospital for the mental and physical rehabilitation of alcoholics. Under the so-called belladonna treatment, my brain cleared. Hydrotherapy and mild exercise helped him. I don't even know what mild exercise is. I wish I could figure. I mean, was he like get up out of bed,
walk
up
around,
and sit down?
Yeah.
I don't know.
He was walk around.
I don't know what that is.
Best of all, I met a kind doctor who explained that though certainly selfish and foolish, I had been seriously ill both bodily and mentally. And so basically he's going to tell us about Dr. Silkworth, what Dr. Silkworth told him about having a physical allergy and a mental obsession.
Down at the bottom of page 7 in the center of that paragraph, my weary and despairing wife was informed that it would all end in heart failure, delirium tremens, or I would develop a wet brain, perhaps within a year. She would soon have to give me over to the undertaker or the asylum. And when I read that heart failure thing and I started to apply it towards my compulsive overeating, like I knew those Smarties were pushing me towards diabetes. I knew that was like the doctor was going to go, yeah, you're insulin bound for the rest of your life if you don't stop eating Smarties the way you do and everything else, you know. And either it was that or, you know, I was going to be that person that needed, you know, the fire department to cut my door jam and the crane to come and get me out of my house. Like, I knew that's where I was going. When I read this, I thought, yeah, that's my lot in life. If I don't apply spiritual principles to my disease and work these steps.
And my heart failure part was actually heart failure because I drank so much Diet Coke. And I couldn't sleep, so I had to take medication to sleep. And my food plan at the time when I came into Overeaters Anonymous was, they used to have this device that popped popcorn without oil. It was a hot popper. It's like a hairdryer that is used to pop popcorn. And I used to have a big salad bowl like this, so I'd make a couple of gallons of popcorn, and I have a liter of Diet Coke. And that was my food plan. And my sponsor said, oh, well, that's not a food plan. That's making cement. So you don't feel anymore. Because I didn't want to feel anymore. And that was the way, that's what I used as kind of mortar. Okay, so the next page number eight.
Page eight. What I've done on page eight is I really found myself in Bill's story. And I'm just going to read the three things that are significant to me and how I found myself in Bill's story. And so at the top of the page, I, who had thought so well of myself and my abilities, of my capacity to surmount obstacles, was cornered at last. Now I was to plunge into a dark, joining that endless procession of thoughts who had gone before me. I thought of my poor wife, and I thought of my poor daughter. There had been much happiness after all. What would I not give to make amends? But that was over now. No words can tell of the loneliness and despair that I found in that bitter morass of self-pity. Quicksand stretched around me in all directions. I had met my match. I had been overwhelmed. Alcohol was my master, and food was my master.
And this is Bill's step one. So this is Bill's. So basically, he wrote this book so he could carry the message. Not face to face. He could send this book to somebody in Alaska, and they could get sober. We can do that here by saying, "Oh, so this is his first step. He was loneliness and despair found in that bitter morass of self pity. He was in serious trouble. He basically surrendered, and that's his step one. And all I have to do in order to make this book of Alcoholics Anonymous fit for me is remember that day when I had my head in the toilet. My daughter was knocking on the door saying, Mommy, Mommy, Mommy. And I was and because I was too busy, I was eating and vomiting, and it was important that I continue doing that. So that's my first step. That's Bill. So get a first step. If you don't have it already, put it on a sticky note right here by Bill's first step.
Yeah. The bottom of the third paragraph, the paragraph starts with trembling, but at the bottom it says, I was soon to be catapulted into what I like to call the fourth dimension of existence. I was to know happiness, peace, and usefulness in a way of life that is incredibly more wonderful as time passes. Now, when I read this for the very first time, I can guarantee you I had not been catapulted. I was not in a happy, peaceful, useful place in my life, but today, 6 years later, I can find myself here in Bill's story one more time because I was catapulted once I started. So hopefully you, too, have been catapulted or can be catapulted quickly.
And so we're still in Bill's story. We're still on page eight. At the very bottom of the page, he's going to start telling us a story about his friend Roland, Abby Thatcher, who basically he and Abby were old friends from Vermont. And Abby was a chronic drunk, and he had gotten arrested many times for doing silly things when he was drunk. But Abby and Bill were really good friends from when they were little in Vermont. And Abby calls Bill on the phone. And so this is a story about when Abby and Bill got together, and Bill says he was sober. And this is written in italics. And the reason why is because Abby was never sober. It was
ever.
Like a big deal. He was sober.
It was shocking.
Holy
it
crap.
Was shocking. He wrote it in italics because he couldn't believe it still when he's writing it.
And so in the middle of the page, number nine, it says, Bill says, so Abby comes over to visit. And so Bill says.
Coming over.
Bill says, come, what's this all about? Like, what's going on? And Abby says.
He looked straight at me. And simply but smilingly, he said, I've got religion.
And it's like, holy crap.
Bye.
The Seventh-day Adventist no problem with that. But when people come and knock on my door and try to hand me the literature, I just think, no. Don't do that. And that's what Bill thought. Holy crap, he's there in his house. Abby's there, and he's going to get the Watchtower or whatever.
Right.
No problem with the Watchtower. I have no problem.
And I'll tell you what, for my experience in Alcoholics Anonymous was, you know, when I first got there, you know, you get there and the 12 steps are on the wall and you go, here's what happened for me. And this is in May of 2007, my first exposure to 12 steps anywhere. I'm 38 years old and I go, I'm out of here. Bunch of Bible beaters, gotta go. I stayed sober 17 days, like white knuckle sober, 17 days. And I had gone to three meetings, and I thought, you know, I went to the first meeting and thought, okay, you got to do something three times before you give it up. You got to, you know, eat lemon and water 3 days before you decide you can't do it anymore. Whatever. That's how I operated. And I had so much religion. And God and I were in a massive fight. Like, we had not been talking for a very long time. And I was raised in a home where I was raised Catholic and Seventh-day Adventist concurrently. I went to Sabbath with my dad on Saturday in the tight pigtails and the polyester dress. And then I had to go to Mass with my mom on Sunday. And I was like the religious pawn of our family. Even though there were five of us, I was the one that got picked to be dragged along. And I still to this day believe that that's grace, because somehow God let them know this one needs a little bit of more of me. The rest of them are going to be okay, but drag this one with you because she's screwed. And as a result of that, I also grew up and thought, well, I'm not going to be a Catholic or a Seventh-day Adventist. I'm going to be a Baptist. And then that didn't work, so I became a Jehovah's Witness. So
we don't have any problem with any
right.
of those. She's happy now. But
today I'm a Buddhist, just in case anybody's wondering.
So Abby says to Bill, I've got religion, and Bill thinks, holy crap, how am I going to get rid of this? And he actually says, that's okay, I've got a bunch of gin stashed underneath my bed, it's okay, I'll let him rant on.
Right.
And then he somehow realizes, he was shocked but interested.
Right.
Certainly he was interested. He says, I had to be, for I was hopeless. So basically, you may not be interested, if people, especially people who come in and they see the third step, like having made a decision to turn my will and my life over to God as I understand Him, and they see that and think, "Oh, I'm screwed, totally screwed." But you
and
know,
I'm not drinking the Kool-Aid. That's what I would say. I'm not drinking that Kool-Aid. It's not happening, and I'm not buying the Amway. I'm not doing it.
Yeah,
but Bill, right here, Bill says, I'm interested. I might buy the Amway and I might drink the Kool-Aid.
Yeah.
And eventually that was my experience.
So he says, I had always believed in a power greater than myself. I had often pondered these things. I was not an atheist. Few people really are, for that means blind faith in the strange proposition that the universe originated in a cipher and aimlessly rushes nowhere. So Bill's saying, it's okay, I'm not an atheist. My mind can be open a tiny bit. And then another sentence down, I had little doubt there was a mighty purpose and rhythm underlay it all. And then at the bottom of the very this page, so we're on page 10, at the very bottom of the page, he realized that a God personal to me, who was love, superhuman strength, and direction. I became irritated. Oh, when he thought of that, he became irritated. My mind snapped shut against such a theory. So basically, he's giving us his example of how his mind snapped shut. My mind snaps shut all the time. Contempt prior to investigation, I think no. Before, I think yes. I always think no. Somebody asked me to a party, I think no. Somebody asked me to go out with them, no. My kid says they want something, no. That's my first reaction. And I always have to kind of pry myself open. And Bill is the same way. How can I not love Bill? I'm like him. So
they are arguing. Page 11 is just one big religious argument between Bill and Ebby. They're arguing about God. They're arguing about a religion. And we're going to read.
Just at the bottom of the page. He sat here. Here sat. So Bill's saying that Ebby's in front of him. And he's saying, here sat a miracle directly across the kitchen table. He shouted great tidings. Because Bill knew it would have been impossible for Ebby to not drink. He saw him his whole life. Ebby could not drink. He had been arrested many times.
Right.
And he saw the miracle.
And he says, I saw my friend was, and so here's his proof. That's his proof. I saw that my friend was much more than inwardly reorganized. He was on a different footing. His roots grasped new soil. And if you spend enough time in Overeaters Anonymous and you start sponsoring newcomers, you see that root grasping take place. You see the light come on. And I know that we sit in meetings with people all the time that walk through the door as newcomers, and you think, oh man, they need help. And you just pray for them and you hope they get it. And then all of a sudden, one day they walk in and you're like, whoa, roots, new soil. Like, the whole thing is just such a miracle. We are so lucky to see it all.
And then despite the living example of my friend there, remained in me the vestiges of my old prejudice. Even though he saw that Evie had a relationship with God and that it was working, he still had an old prejudice. The word God still aroused a certain antipathy. When the thought was expressed that there might be a God personal to me, this feeling was intensified.
Yeah.
And so Ebby gets tired of arguing with Bill. He's been arguing with Bill for a couple hours. And finally Ebby says, Bill, in italics, middle of the page, it says, Bill, why don't you choose your own conception of God? And that rocked Bill's world. That just the concept that we can pick our own. See, we can pick our own higher power. You don't have to pick the Baptist. You don't. I'm an Episcopalian. You don't have to pick mine. Pick a higher power. A lot of people I go to program with are. I live in Dana Point. They are. They go to the beach. They go to the beach and sit by the ocean, and that's their higher power. So basically, this is a really important part of this of Bill's story. Why don't you choose your own conception of God? And then down the next paragraph
in italics, he says, "I stood in the sunlight at last. It was only a matter of being willing to believe in a power greater than myself. Nothing more was required of me to make my beginning. I saw that growth could start from that point. Upon a foundation of complete willingness, I might build what I saw in my friend. Would I have it? Of course I would.
Thus was I convinced that God is concerned with us, humans, when we want him enough. And then I just want to say, we're going to talk about this. Bill does this metaphor. He talks about a building. He's building a building, and the first part of the building is the foundation. So he's saying, upon a foundation of complete willingness. So just remember, in the next couple hours, I'll talk about another part of that building. But right now, he's talking about the foundation, and the foundation is willingness. Okay? And then the next page, page number 13.
Page 13, we're going to read pretty much the whole page, starting with, there I humbly offered. So, there I humbly offered myself to God as I then understood him to do with me as he would. I placed myself unreservedly under his care and direction. I admitted for the first time that of myself I was nothing, that without him I was lost. I ruthlessly faced my sins and became willing to have my newfound friend take them away, root and branch. I have not had a drink since.
So this paragraph is his step three and step four. He did step four. He was still in the hospital doing step four.
My schoolmate visited me, and I fully acquainted him with my problems and deficiencies.
He's talking about step five.
We made a list of people I had hurt or towards whom I had felt resentment.
That's step eight.
I expressed my willingness to approach these individuals, admitting my wrong.
That's step nine.
Never was I to be critical of them. I was to right all such matters to the utmost of my ability.
And then the next paragraph, the second sentence, common sense would thus become uncommon sense. So he's already talking about what's happening to him just after doing the step five, six, seven, eight, and nine. I was to sit quietly when in doubt.
Step 11.
Asking only for direction and strength to meet my problems as he would have me. He, as in God, would have me. Never was I to pray for myself except as my request bore on the usefulness to others. And then at the very, very bottom of the page, the last sentence on the page, belief in the power of God plus enough willingness, honesty, and humility to establish and maintain the new order of things were the essential requirements. And this is like requirements as in not of suggestions.
Right.
These are requirements.
Okay.
In page number 14.
Page 14 in the second paragraph, second sentence, there was a sense of victory followed by such a peace and serenity as I had ever known. There was utter confidence. I felt lifted up as though the great wind of a mountaintop blew through and through. God comes to most men gradually, that's me, but his impact on me was sudden and profound. This is Bill's white light experience. This is his, you know, face-to-face moment with his creator. This is what happens. And we're going to go down to the bottom of the page, the second to the last paragraph. While I lay in the hospital, the thought came that there were thousands of hopeless compulsive overeaters who might be glad to have what I had been so freely given to me. Perhaps I could help some of them. They, in turn, might work with others.
So he's talking about step 12. And then at the very bottom of the page, he says, faith without works was dead, he said. And how appallingly true for the alcoholic compulsive overeater. For if a compulsive overeater failed to perfect and enlarge his spiritual life through work and self-sacrifice for others, he could not survive the certain trials and low spots ahead. If he did not work, he would surely drink again, and if he drank, he'd eat again, and if he compulsively ate, he would surely die. Then faith would be dead indeed. So he's trying to give us an example of how faith without works is dead. Look, it's one thing to believe in God. It's one thing to get sober and abstinent. It's one thing to have your food obsession to be removed, but that's not going to last long if you're not working with others, and that's what he's saying there.
In the middle of that second paragraph, he says, I was not too well at the time, and I was plagued by waves of self-pity and resentment. This sometimes nearly drove me back to drink, but I soon found that when all other measures failed, work with another alcoholic or compulsive overeater would save the day. It's a design for living that works in rough doing. So he's given us a design for living, and that's the last sentence of that second paragraph. And the very first line of that next paragraph, we commenced to make many fast friends, and a fellowship has grown up among us of which it is a wonderful thing to feel a part. The joy of living we really have under pressure and difficulty.
And then the next page is page number 16. It's the last page of the of Bill's story, and it's the last two paragraphs. It starts with, there is, however, and he's talking about basically his life now, because this is the last time we hear from Bill specifically about himself in the big book. And he's saying, there is, however, a vast amount of fun about it all. I suppose some would be shocked at our seeming worldliness and levity, but just underneath there is a deadly earnestness. Faith has to work 24 hours a day and through us, or we perish.
Most of us feel we need look no further for utopia. We have it with us right here and now. Each day, my friend's simple talk in our kitchen multiplies itself in a widening circle of peace on earth and goodwill to men.
So Bill's basically saying that one moment when he and Ebby talked in his kitchen has multiplied times, you know, 2 million people in AA. I don't know how many people in OA. I'm not clear on that. But a lot. And basically, that just one compulsive overeater talking to another compulsive overeater is transformational. Okay? Now, we're gonna even though it's early, we're going to break and do the Ask It Basket. Thank
right.
you. Okay.
Okay. I'll read. You want me to read them to you?
So we're going
to
stop for just a second from the reading, and we're going to you start.
Okay. How did you use step one to help you define a sustainable abstinence and concrete food plan? Go ahead. Want to answer that?
No, you answer it. I was reading.
Okay, so I actually have. Wait, these are getting stuck together. Imagine that. Hold on 1 second. Because I have stickies too. That's right. So again, how did you use step one to help you define a sustainable abstinence and a concrete food plan? Okay, so I had to list all the ways, my sponsor said, you have to list all the ways that your life has become unmanageable and how you are powerless over food. So for me, I have a list, and we actually read that a little bit later, but I'll read it now if I can find it. It's a good list. What page is your list on?
I'm going to tell you in a minute.
Okay. Here we go. So this is my first step. These are my ways to control and enjoy my eating. Alcohol only. Tequila is an excellent way to diet. That's what I did. Tequila only. And that's when I reached my smallest weight. I've tried the Hollywood diet. I've had gastric bypass. I've had Sensa, Slim Fast, lemon and water, Master Cleanser, starving myself, Weight Watchers, Atkins diet, and Bikram yoga. Those are the things that I can do left to my own devices, my own power, that will put me in the size body, I think, that you need me in to love me.
And my list of how is this the question? How do we control our weight, control and enjoy our eating?
No, it says how do you use step one to define a sustainable, abstinent, and concrete food plan. So right then and there, I can't do this. I cannot ever do this again if I want to be abstinent. I cannot do those things. I cannot go back on the Hollywood diet. I cannot starve myself. I cannot just drink tequila. Those are part of the things that define my abstinence.
Right. Okay, so the step one in the workbook is really helpful because it basically talks about the Overeaters Anonymous workbook. It basically talks about make a list of all the time of all the crap you've done around food and how crappy you feel. And I don't think that's what it says, but it's kind of like that. And I think that's really helpful because basically I start off with thinking, I can remember I grew up in Manhattan Beach and my mom and dad had charge accounts. This is so long ago in the 50s. My mom and dad had charge accounts at Colette's Liquor, Becker's Bakery, and Manhattan Grocery.
So
okay,
lucky.
And I would go. They'd send me up without, like, a 7-year-old walk into the store, and so it was before perverts. And I would go and get a loaf of bread for me and a loaf of bread for my mom, and that's what I did. And then later, Colette's Liquor delivered, and it didn't matter that I was 16. That just wasn't a problem. So basically, I started to control my food with alcohol, and that was very effective until it wasn't effective anymore. I'll save my list for later. But I nailed down some of the things that were problems for me. Like, obviously, my example is glazed donuts. I don't eat glazed donuts. But also, here's the other part of my story. And this is just my story. My goal is to stay here. That's it. I've had complete traffic jam, crazy car wrecks of food days in my life in Overeaters Anonymous. My goal is to stay here. If I make a restrictive food plan, I'm gone. See ya. I'll be working my steps perfectly in Alcoholics Anonymous. Okay? I have to find a food plan that is adjustable. And that will, and that I can, at the end of the day, I can still love myself. So however that looks to you, and it may be for you, no sugar, no white flour, you go. I did no sugar from 1986 until 2004. And that was awesome until I didn't do it anymore. And it wasn't like I all of a sudden kind of went crazy. It was just that it was like, I don't know, I just changed. And my concept is I'm a moderate mealer. I think moderate mealers are like, that's my goal. So I don't know if that's the answer to the question. What's the next question?
Yeah, that actually answers the question, what does entire abstinence mean to both of you? And I can share Roxanne's belief. And what I like about when they talk about the fellowship and how it grows up around us, like I've attached myself to women and Overeaters Anonymous that stay no matter what. And I've been able to do that. And that is part of my abstinence. My abstinence is to stay no matter what. If I gain a pound, I stay. If I lose a pound, I stay. And eating in moderation is huge for me. And believe it or not, I can eat a row of Smarties today and not pick them up, for a year if I have to. I am no longer blocked off from the sunlight of the spirit because of anything that I put in my body, and that's how I can define my abstinence. So
yeah, and also I choose meetings that are loving meetings. I used to go to a lot of other meetings, and I'm not anti-How or anti-Acorn or any other. OA meetings are awesome, but I choose to go to meetings where I feel loved, period, and not judged about what I eat or whatever. But that is me. And the wonderful thing about Overeaters Anonymous that's wonderful and challenging is, well, here's my experience. I have to find a food plan that works for me, and I have to find a food plan that makes me love myself. And if I can love myself, I can stay here. That's my goal. I get to stay here. If I want to line up with the people who say, there are some wonderful, sober, abstinent women who go to programs that have very restrictive food plans. If I can do that and love myself, awesome. But the goal, even though it says Overeaters Anonymous, the goal for me is self-love. And it took me a long time. I've been in Overeaters Anonymous 27 years. It took me a long time to figure out, wow, when I leave that meeting, I always want to eat three cheeseburgers. What the F? Mm-hmm. Why do I want to eat three? I want to go to In-N-Out and sit there. And when I do that over and over again at a meeting, then that may not be the perfect meeting for me. I judge no man. Okay. What is the next question?
How has your plan of action and food plan plus abstinence changed or evolved as your recovery has progressed?
I just answered that.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
You want to talk about that?
Well, I do want to say this. I like this. This question asks if we have an outline discussed in the workshop on all the pages, specific words that could be sent or shared or emailed as a handout. And we do have not necessarily specific words, but we do have a
outline.
We have like a chart we can email you. So if you want to give us your email, I'll be happy
She's
to email it
really
to you.
Really good at emailing.
I'll be happy That's to perfect. Email it to you after the workshop today.
I have to interject here because there is an OA Vision for You phone meeting, and it is connected with just OA. It's not from one of the offshoots or anything. And I listen to it at 4 a.m., from 4 to 6 a.m., and it's pure Big Book. The women are calling them, and men are calling themselves recovered. They're from all over the world, 250 people on the phone. And they're studying the first 164 pages. And I love it because I do come from that offshoot, very restrictive. And I did 15 years of killing myself, 300 pounds gain and lost, a gazillion times with the psychological, like what you were saying, and I came back to OA to a more relaxed, moderate mealing thing. And it's a beautiful abstinence. But I wanted to talk about Vision for You because it's pure Big Book. And they're saying whatever your binge items are, they're not into food plans. They don't even want to hear about 90-day
yeah.
primary purpose. They don't want to hear any of that. It's like, are you a compulsive eater? And it's foods and eating behaviors. And
so maybe you could write that down.
Yeah.
And so we'll have it up here at the,
yeah,
end,
okay,
the end of the
okay.
meeting. We could, because I think that would be a great resource.
Yes.
And then is there another one?
Did I think I just read this one? How has your plan of action and food plan abstinence changed and evolved as your recovery has progressed? And again, that... like when I came to OA, I had been off sugar for I want to say 60 or either 63 or 33 days. I can't remember because it was like, you know, you're hunkered down and I haven't had any sugar and I'm, you know, and every single phone call to my sponsor was, I'm going to punch this person. I'm going to kick this person's ass. And it was like this battle. And then I would call her before I had to go to this other meeting where they had cookies. And I'm like, I hate going to that meeting because they have those fucking old man cookies and I got that. And I'm freaking out. She goes, why don't you just have a cookie? Like the thought of just having a cookie, I couldn't conceive of it. I couldn't conceive of it. I was so blinded by anger and blocked from the spirit because of what was going on with me. And when she said that, I was like, oh, I can do that? Well, I thought, you know, and because I had no idea. I had no knowledge of what Overeaters Anonymous was about. I knew you had 12 steps. I was like, I'm in. I'm drinking your 12-step Kool-Aid. But I had no idea. And so what's changed and evolved is, I can go to that meeting and I can have a cookie. I can go to that meeting and not have a cookie and I can still remain abstinent. Mm-hmm. And I'm not punching people in the face and or wanting to.
Yeah, I went to a meeting.
Which is a huge difference.
I went to a meeting last week and there it was another, not an OA meeting, and a lady had made a plate of cookies and my girlfriend who I sat next to, she leaned over and she said, don't waste your cookie on that one. They're not good. And I thought, great, I didn't
nice
have to threaten. Yeah. Okay, no, I didn't get this. Could you explain that?
This one says, make many resolutions but not a decision. Okay, that's on page. Let me find it for you.
Because
the person wants
Jeopardy.
Us to elaborate and... and tell you the page. That's gonna. That might be a little bit harder.
We
may have to come
to
back to
yeah,
that one at the very beginning of the next session. So, or wait. I'll find it while we're page 30.
Yeah.
Okay, hold on.
Oh, Roman numeral.
Oh yeah.
Well done, you.
Right. Very good.
Okay.
Here we go. So, right. He says they are over remorseful and make many resolutions, but never a decision. Right. So. And you're asking us to elaborate.
Uh-huh.
I will elaborate my experience at many a resolution, but never a decision. I would, so if you make a decision, it's only, and we get into this later, it's only as good as the action that's followed up by it. And I think if you've worked the steps, you know that. So, and my favorite,
yeah, do
description.
The frog.
I'm going to mess up the frog story, but people are going to get it, right? So there's three frogs on a log, and two of them decide to jump in the pond. How many are left on the log?
Three.
Right, yeah. Because the decision has been made, but there's no action that's followed it
right.
up. So I can say my experience, there have been many a resolution. So I'm gonna get on the Hollywood diet and do it perfectly. I'm gonna drink the Hollywood juice and I'm gonna eat the Hollywood cookie once a day, and I'm gonna do that for the rest of my life, and I'm gonna be happy. I'm gonna be happy, joyous, and free if I do that. I'm only gonna drink water. Right? I only need water. You don't need anything else. Water's okay. I can never fully buy in to whatever it is I think I'm going to do or whatever it is I say I'm going to do. I might dazzle you over here with something shiny and do it for a day or two, but, you know, then the next shiny thing comes along and that's bigger, better, and faster, so I'm going to go there.
Yeah. And so the question is, make a resolution, not a decision. And basically, the decision isn't going to work for me either. You can make a resolution and a decision, but if you don't take the action, it doesn't really matter. And I have made a ton of resolutions. And, you know, I always decide, I'm going to try and think, can I say this on the tape?
Okay. Sure.
I always decide to get a divorce on a Saturday. And I got to tell you, there are no divorce attorneys available on Saturdays. And I think that's a big business plan for the future. An attorney needs to just open on Saturday and Sunday. And basically, I've made decisions. I've made resolutions. I've made decisions. This is it. I'm divorcing him. I've been married for 33 years to a really good man. And the reason why I know God's in my life is that I only want to divorce him on Saturday and Sunday, and there's no attorneys available. So on Monday, he's awesome. And so I don't think I answered that, but I entertained myself.
So step 4 through 12 are the action steps.
So step four. 4 through 12 are the action steps. And basically, if you want to do this, since we have a minute,
right.
we're gonna do this. I'm going to take you through the
table of contents.
Go to your table of contents, because it's going to be super fun. So basically, we have this chart. We do have this chart, right?
That's the chart I'll email.
Okay, so we don't have this chart available for you, but we have this chart, and Linda will email it to you. All you have to do is and basically it looks like this. She's going to email it to you. It looks like this, and it basically has three items: the problem, the solution, and the plan of action. The problem is it's powerless, right? And that's chapters the doctor's opinion, and chapter one, Bill's story. And then the solution is power. And power that's equals God, and then we'll talk about where these come from. But basically, the solution is power. That's God, and that's chapter two. There is a solution. Chapter three, more about alcoholism, and chapter four, we agnostics. And then the plan of action, that comes from the Oxford movement, and that's chapters five, how it works, all the way. That's it. After everything after chapter five.
Right.
Okay, and so that's how the big book is lined up. And also there's that subtext of what Bill talks about, the building that he's building, the arch that we walk through freedom. He's talking about, we already heard about the foundation being willingness. Then he's going to talk about a keystone, and he's going to talk about cornerstone, and then he talks about the keystone. And those things happen later. We'll talk about them later. But the basic format of the big book, he is organized to be a 12-step call. So if you can actually get sober and abstinent just by reading the book, it's not as easy, because you don't have us or someone else to give you examples, but it's possible. And there's a ton of people in Overeaters Anonymous who do big book workshops. The first one I heard was in 1987, and it was by a girl named Janet Roberts who lived in Iowa. And it rocked my world. And from that moment, I was obsessed with the big book as it related to Overeaters Anonymous, because I have a lot of opinions about that. But I just want to tell you that the table of contents really helps you line out how it's organized, and helps you understand, you know, why we have to start at step one and stay in order, because there's a reason for that.
I have to tell you, this is the only thing I'm so excited, because I've never in my life had the obsession to eat my binge items listed. And because of this big book, first 164 pages, and Harlan, who took me through the steps, you can shove a pizza down my throat if you wanted to right now. I just took it away months ago through Christmas. Mm. I don't want to eat chocolate candy, whatever my binge items are. And it was this work through the 4th, 5th, 6th, and then the daily 10th, 11th, 12th.
Yeah.
Call him up, Harlan, I'm feeling pissed off. My brother got me mad. And then we do a 4th, 5th, 6th, 10-step call. And the obsession is completely gone. I just have to say that because
it worked.
It really happened.
It worked.
Me.
Yeah. Somebody had their hand up. No, never mind. Okay. Erase.
All right.
Okay.
Great. Okay, that's it.
That's
Thanks.
It. So you get to go off early. We're going to be back here at 2 o'clock. We'll start from there is a solution, and then go through till page like 76.
76.
Okay? And so...